We're going to start by completing chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, and we'll start on verse 15b, and then we will continue through the end of chapter 14. Saul counted the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Saul, his son Jonathan, and the people who were present with them stayed in Geba of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped at Michmash. And raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah to the land of Shual. Another company turned toward Beth Horon. And another company turned toward the mountain that looks down upon the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Now there was no smith to be found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, "The Hebrews must not make swords or spears for themselves." So all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen their plowshares, mattocks, axes, or sickles. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, or 1/3 of a shekel for the sharpening the axes and for setting the goads. So on the day of the battle, neither sword nor spear was to be found in the possession of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan, but Saul and his son Jonathan had them. Now a garrison of the Philistines had gone out to the pass of Michmash. One day Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree that is at Migron. The troops that were with him were about 600 men, along with Ahijah, son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, carrying an ephod. Now the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. In the pass by which Jonathan tried to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side and a rocky crag on the other. The name of the one was Bozez, the name of the other Senna. One crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Geba. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will act for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." His armor bearer said to him, "Do all that your mind inclines to. I am with you. As your mind is, so is mine." Then Jonathan said, "Now we will cross over to those men and will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. That will be the sign for us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, "Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." The men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer, saying, "Come up to us, and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, with his armor bearer following after him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer, coming after him, killed them. In that first slaughter, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed about 20 men within an area about half a furrow long in an acre of land. There was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. Saul's lookouts in Gibeah of Benjamin were watching as the multitude was surging back and forth. Then Saul said to the troops that were with him, "Call the roll and see who has gone from us." When they called the roll, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time the ark of God went with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. And Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. And every sword was against the other, so that there was very great confusion. Now the Hebrews, who previously had been with the Philistines and had gone up with them into the camp, turned and joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the Israelites had gone into hiding in the hill country of Ephraim and heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed closely after them in battle. So the Lord gave Israel the victory that day. The battle passed beyond Beth-Aven, and the troops with Saul numbered altogether about 10,000 men. The battle spread out over the hill country of Ephraim. Now Saul committed a very rash act on that day. He laid an oath on the troops, saying, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before it is evening, and I have been avenged on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. All the troops came upon a honeycomb, and there was honey on the ground. When the troops came upon the honeycomb, the honey was dripping out, but they did not put their hands to their mouths, for they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the troops with the oath, so he extended the staff that was in his hand and dipped the tip of it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the soldiers said, "Your father strictly charged the troops with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be anyone who eats food this day,' and so the troops are faint." Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if today the troops had eaten freely of the spoil taken from their enemies, for now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great." After they had struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, the troops were very faint. So the troops flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the troops ate them with the blood. Then it was reported to Saul, "Look, the troops are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone before me here." Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the troops and say to them, 'Let all bring their oxen or their sheep and slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" So all of the troops brought their oxen with them that night and slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and despoil them until the morning light. Let us not leave one of them." They said, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." So Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. Saul said, "Come here, all you leaders of the people, and let us find out how this sin has arisen today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, even if it is in my son Jonathan, he shall surely die." But there was no one among all the people who answered him. He said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I and my son Jonathan will be on the other side." The people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Then Saul said, "O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant today? If this guilt is in me or in my son Jonathan, O Lord God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is in your people Israel, give Thummim." And Jonathan and Saul were indicated by the lot, but the people were cleared. Then Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and my son Jonathan," and Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the tip of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I will die." Saul said, "God do so to me and more also. You shall surely die, Jonathan." Then the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great victory in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God today." So the people ransomed Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul withdrew from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. When Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. He did valiantly and struck down the Amalekites and rescued Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Machuziah. And the names of his daughters, two daughters, were these. The name of the firstborn was Merib, and the name of the younger, Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, daughter of Ahinoaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any strong or valiant warrior, he took him into his service. The word of the Lord. Okay, from here on out, we're taking turns with these readings. Because these Hebrew names are just killing me.
Yeah. I don't sound with you.
Yeah. I took the Greek seminary, not Hebrew. They used to require you to take 2 years of both, but you can't keep up with these ancient languages. You have to do them every day, and that just doesn't happen a lot of times when you're in service. So I took a different track and specialized in theology. So Saul's down to 600 men, and that's not many, especially when you consider the enormous force that the Philistines had brought together earlier in chapter 13, verse 5. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 cavalry, troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. So they're in a bad way. And the Philistines have sent out raiding parties to the north and to the south and to the east. Of course, to the west of them is their territory, so no reason to do that. And these two armies, if you want to call Saul's 600 men an army, were facing each other across a ravine that was defined by two ridges. The Philistines were on the north at Michmash, and the Israelites were at the south at Gela. And, you know, it seems that the Philistines, with this mighty force that they deployed, have gained a lot of ground. And in the process, they've essentially monopolized blacksmiths. For them to get their farm implements sharpened, they have to go to the Philistines, which had to have been a humiliating experience and a fairly expensive one. But the Philistines obviously were not going to allow them to come there to have weapons forged or sharpened. And so that put the Israelites at a significant disadvantage. And this detail, along with many others in this battle story, emphasize Yahweh's role in bringing the victory to Israel. Yes, they did some amazing things, but the only reason they were able to do these amazing things against the Philistines and later on against others was because Yahweh was guiding them and guarding them. Now, there's a reference, a couple, in the passage we just read to the Hebrews, and so I think it's worthwhile to pause for just a moment to talk about what this means. And we discussed it at length when we studied Exodus. For foreigners, Hebrews was a common name for the Israelites. But the Hebrews were a broader group than Israel themselves. They were ethnically related, but you could look at Israel as sort of a subset of the Hebrews. MacArthur, in his commentary, describes them as disenfranchised people of mixed origin who banded together out of mutual interest. And based on some Akkadian root words, Hebrew might be a transliteration of nomadic herders who occasionally would strike against more established civilizations and even try to take over some of the land for grazing. Chapter 14 opens up with Jonathan, Saul's son, kind of going out on his own with his armor bearer looking for trouble. And he doesn't bother to tell Dad. And this narrative, as soon as it gets started, is interrupted by letting us know where Saul is, who's with him, and that he didn't know that Jonathan had gone. And the path that Jonathan and his armor-bearer trod was a very difficult one. Obviously, there's a lot of steep terrain. We learn in following verses that, you know, to climb up to the Philistine position, Jonathan had to go to his hands and his knees. But these place names, Bozez and Senna, Bozez translates as swamp, basically. and Senna means thorny ground. So they had a really rough road. And this is not so much a foreshadowing of the difficult military campaign that lay ahead, but more interpersonal and theological problems that will be revealed at the end of chapter 14. Again, Jonathan makes clear to his armor bearer that we're going to win, and the reason because of it will be God. And then what you see in verses 8 through 12 is Jonathan's allowing the Philistines to choose the battlefield. He's basically saying, we'll reveal ourselves to them, and if they say, we're coming out to you, we'll stand here and fight them here. And if they say, come up to us, we'll go up to their stronghold and fight them there. And the Philistines, gorged on success and probably feeling a little arrogant and complacent, say, come on up, we'll show you something. Big mistake. Big mistake. So they climb up, and the two of them end up killing about 20 people within a fairly compact area of land. I could not figure out anywhere what half a furrow long in an acre is. If you can calculate that or look it up, I'm very eager to know what that is. But I think what it symbolizes in small space. Small space. So,
Michael,
yeah.
It's what an oxen can plow every day. A yoke.
Okay. Okay. Very good.
Yeah, it's good.
And so, I mean, you would think that this substantial force wouldn't freak out over two guys who have managed to kill 20 people. But they do. There's a huge panic. They're trembling. Which can also be translated as shuddering or convulsing. It's really reminiscent of what happened earlier in chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, when the Israelites were fighting against the Philistines and things weren't going well. And the Israelites said, hey, you know what might help? Let's get the Ark of the Covenant. And they bring the Ark of the Covenant into their camp. And they start going crazy, like rock stars come in. And the Philistines are like, what's going on over there? And when they figure it out, they're just absolutely terrified. And so basically, that's what's happening here. Another indication that even the Philistines know that Jonathan and his armor bearer are triumphing because God is empowering them to do so. So Saul's sentries are keeping watch. And they see that something's happening over there. And Saul is curious about what's happening, so I think he might suspect that some of his troops have gone off on their own to try to make trouble. And so he calls the roll, and they discover that Jonathan and his armor bearer are missing. And then in verse 18, things start to get a little bit on the confusing side. Saul asks Ahijah to bring the Ark of God here. Now, you may have a little footnote in your Bible that says the Greek reads the ephod. And so we're not sure if Saul's calling for the Ark of the Covenant or if Saul's calling for an ephod. And again, depending on which ancient source you're using, it could be either one or the other. It's more likely the ephod that he's calling for because of the role the ephod plays through the remainder of chapter 14 and the fact that elsewhere in this chapter the ark isn't mentioned. So I'm reading it ephod. And what the ephod was, it was a garment that the priests would wear. The details on what that was made out of you can find in Exodus chapters 28 and 29. This is a very ornate garment, and it includes either on the breastplate or perhaps in a special pocket two stones, the Urim and the Thummim. And these were stones that were used to divine God's will. Limited, because they could only give you a yes, no, you, them kind of answer. But obviously Saul's desire here isn't to summon the ark to lead the people into battle, because as he's talking with the priest and he sees the Philistine encampment becoming more and more disordered, he says to the priest, and this is in verse 19, withdraw your hand. This is what indicates that perhaps these two stones, which were probably differentiated in color, we think they were black and white, and probably had two separate inscriptions on them, perhaps the first and last letters in the Hebrew alphabet, that these were contained in the special pocket. So he's basically asking the priest, help me figure out what God wants me to do. But we don't know what the result was, and it's possible that Saul sets out even before he's given the result, because they rally, they go into battle, and of course battles are very confusing. The tide turns. The Hebrews, who had been allied with the Philistines up to this point, it was a fickle group, I suppose. And again, remember, this is a group that's affiliated with ethnically, but still distinct from Israel. They turn on the Philistines and join with the Israelites, and then the people who had been hiding in the caves heard that things were going well, and so they popped up like gophers and came out and helped too. So Saul goes from 600 to 10,000 men. Nothing makes you more popular than victory. So things are going good, but then Saul makes a mistake. Probably in order to curry God's favor, he imposes a fast on the troops until nightfall, which is just stupid. Because fighting takes a little bit of energy. And so this was going to weaken his troops. So they refuse to eat because he threatens to curse them. And they're frightened by that. And they even come past some honeycomb and they refrain, and you have to admire their discipline. But Jonathan, of course, wasn't around to hear this. And so he saw the honey. He was like, oh, gosh, I'm hungry. So he had some. And his eyes were brightened, which just means that he felt better. You know, he got a little bit of a recharge. I mean, it's pure sugar. So, and then one of the soldiers who saw him do this said, hey, your dad said you can't do this. He swore an oath and we're cursed if we eat. But then it mentions the troops were faint. And Jonathan scoffs at Saul's command and he says, my father has troubled the land. See, I'm doing really well now that I've had some honey. And we would be doing much better in this battle against the Philistines if everybody could have had some. So they managed to basically rout the Philistines, they capture their livestock, and they're famished. I mean, just imagine a day of running around and killing people. I mean, you're going to be pretty hungry. And they just basically slaughter these animals where they stood to eat. And Saul gets the report that an immense sin is being committed because they're eating the animals with the blood. And this is not kosher. Blood is regarded as the essence of life. And so you had to drain the blood out of an animal before you could eat it. And then the blood of the animal had to be offered to God, because only God was worthy to consume the essence of life. And I've given you some references, Genesis chapter 9, verse 4, Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, and Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 23, just three among many of citations in the Torah that speak of this. So Saul calls for a big stone where they can slaughter the animals properly. You cut up the animal on the stone and the blood runs down off the stone. And that way you can then butcher the meat and cook it and eat it. And it appears that Saul took this stone and around it built an altar to God dispersed. Then Saul wants to launch a nighttime attack just to clean up the rest of the Philistines. But the priest says, you know, maybe we want to ask God how he feels about this. And so Saul asks, and there's no answer, which is curious, because you've got two stones, you know, it's going to be one or the other, how do you not get an answer out of that? Well, maybe they decided not to use the stones for this particular act of divination. But anyway, Saul didn't get an answer, and he interprets this as God's punishment for some great sin that's been committed. And you might think that it was because they'd consumed the blood. But Saul doesn't see it that way. He thinks there's something else going on. And to emphasize the severity of the situation, he says, even if it's Jonathan, whoever's done this is going to die. Well, nobody says anything, understandably. And, you know, when you've only got two stones, you have to find a way of dividing the candidates. So he sets himself and Jonathan against the people. And presumably, if the stone had fallen to the people, he would have found a way to divide them up as well. The stone falls to Saul and Jonathan, and then between them, Jonathan gets it. And so Saul wants to know what he's done. Jonathan confesses to having eaten the honey against his father's command and threat of curse, even though he didn't know about it and didn't find out about it until after he'd eaten. But Saul says, well, you know, I said somebody was going to die, and I guess it's going to have to be you. But the army is just like, you got to be out of your mind. Jonathan's done a great thing today. He's the one that you know, gave us the opportunity to defeat the Philistines by going into their encampment and throwing them into a panic. So they ransom him. And the way that this works, and we studied this a little bit in Exodus, in the law, depending upon the circumstances, a person who would otherwise be sentenced to death can be ransomed, either by a sacrifice to God or by a payment in money or in kind to the offending to the offended party. Okay, and so that's basically what the people seem to have done here. And then the battle ends, the Philistines go back home, and the rest of the chapter is basically a summation of what's going to happen next. Saul is king, strikes out against the enemies in the cardinal directions of the compass, defeating the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines, and the Amalekites. And the Moabites had a little strip of land about 60 miles long on the east shore of the Dead Sea, in territory claimed by Reuben, but as we've discussed before, basically everything to the east of the Jordan was contested territory. The Edomites lived south of the Dead Sea. They were actually related to the Israelites, and you can read about that in Genesis chapter 25. But there was a lot of sibling rivalry here. They were often at enmity with each other. Zobah had territory to the north of Israel in present-day Lebanon, in the heights there. And the Amalekites dwelled in the desert region on the southern border of Israel. So if you think about a map of Palestine, kind of to the southwest of the Gaza Strip is where we think the Amalekites were hanging out. And the Ammonites we've already talked about plenty. So it seems that Saul expands the territory of Israel, subdues their enemies, which provides them with a measure of security. The Amalekites, we're going to see more of chapter 15. They're going to play a significant role in Saul's ultimate rejection by the people. And then we're told the principal members of Saul's immediate family, some of which are difficult to pronounce. And then chapter 14 closes with the statement that throughout the course of Saul's reign, there were ongoing intermittent clashes with the Philistines. So that's the second half of chapter 13 and chapter 14. Lovely battle story. And, you know, it's just kind of sad because Saul really means well, but he's just hapless. I mean, he does stupid things, you know. Okay, go out and fight the battle, but leave your rations behind. Weapons and ammo only. You're not eating today. It's not told why he did it, but almost certainly it was, you know, to try to you know, get God on their side by asking his troops to fast, which is a way of putting your faith in God, I suppose. You know, I can do this without eating all day long. You know, I just kind of feel sorry for him. And I think that he's portrayed in this way because this is an element of the tradition that we've inherited, the prophetic sort of line that kingship was a bad idea. And in many ways, Saul illustrated all the reasons why the kingship was a bad idea. Even though he did well in a lot of ways, there were a lot of screw-ups too. So what do you guys see in here, or what questions might you have? Yeah, Caroline.
Do we know how long Saul reigned?
No, it's not clear. If you go back to the very first verse of chapter 13, in my New Revised Standard Version, it says, Saul was ... years old when he began to reign, and he reigned ... and 2 years over Israel. And in the footnotes I have there, the number is lacking in the Hebrew text, and the entire verse is lacking in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew and Aramaic Old Testament. And then the second says two is not the entire number. Something has dropped out. So we really don't know how long he was on the throne. And this, again, is just another instance in which we find throughout 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, the oldest surviving manuscripts conflict, and even they have significant lacunae, and we just don't know. I see you have a timeline there. So what does it say about
Saul at 1050 to 1010?
40 years.
Yeah, maybe.
After Saul comes David.
Yes.
Yeah, after Saul comes David, and all these timelines are dependent on, frankly, guesstimates. I mean, once we get to David, it becomes a little more clear where we are. And so what you do is you start with David, who came to the throne somewhere around 1000 AD. You work your way backwards from what you can glean from Scripture, which in the case of the longevity of Saul's monarchy is really difficult to say. And because this says ... and 2 years. And so instead of an even 40, one might expect a round number plus 2 rather than 38 plus 2. Because 40 was a sacred number. If it was 40, they would have just said 40. So you kind of work your way back through Moses to the patriarchs and the different generations of the ancestors of Jacob. Then we don't really know how many passed between Joseph and the time of Moses. So we do the best that we can. But we have pretty firm archaeological evidence from David on in terms of when these things happened. We have pretty reliable non-biblical literary sources that provide us with very precise timing in terms of when the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom and when the Babylonians conquered the southern kingdom. But yeah, before David, it's, you know, you can get a rough estimate, but it's hard to say. Yes, sir?
If you go back to earlier, chapter, verse 14, chapter 13, it says, "But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has called out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because he has not kept the Lord's command." Is that referring to the fact that he lets Jonathan go and lead the troops?
Well, you know, I think that...
Or are we talking about David later on?
Yeah, basically there's some hints here about David. God's intention was not for there to be an inherited monarchy, but that each king would be selected by Yahweh through the intermediary of a prophet, very much in the same way that Saul was selected. And this doesn't mean that you didn't have an inherited monarchy. You do. And sometimes that's okay. It doesn't seem to be a big problem with Solomon taking over from David. But the farther along you get in the monarchy, and the more consolidated its power, and the more you see sons inheriting from their fathers, the bigger the trouble you see. Because you're getting away from the prophetic anointing of the God-selected king. And what this sort of oracle of judgment is, in verse 14 of chapter 13, is, you remember, Saul was waiting for Samuel 7 days, and Samuel didn't show up on time. And so Saul says, I'll do the sacrifice since Samuel's not around. And that was both feet way over the line. Samuel arrives. What have you done? And this is the condemnation. Your kingship is doomed, and you're not going to have a line to succeed you. And that's what's happening there. But definitely, well, God's incredibly patient, and you know, for better or for worse, and you know, it's God lets this play out, and to a certain extent, it's a mystery as to why. Because you're looking at about a 400 plus year period of time between the inauguration of the monarchy in Saul and the conquest of the northern and then the southern kingdoms in 732 and 587 BC, respectively. And so God lets this play out, and it may be that this is the way of God teaching them a lesson. They're going to be increasingly miserable under the kings, because they're going to become more vulnerable, less secure, and less prosperous. They're going to suffer from incredible economic and judicial injustices. They're going to be exploited, just as Samuel told them they would be, in greater and greater measure as time goes on. And so the people are going to be made miserable by what they asked for. And then their punishment for having done this, and the punishment against the monarchy for having become corrupt, and through the monarchy, the people themselves having become corrupt, not only through injustice, but also through idolatry, is they're going to be conquered. And so they're going to go through this period that gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And just when they think it can't get any worse, it gets worse, because they get beaten and enslaved. So it's a extensive cosmic object lesson with collective punishment.
At the beginning of 13, it talks about how big the Philistine army is.
Yeah.
And then I think this all showing with Saul showing a great faith in God, or is he just totally dumb? In the sense, well, it says out of his army of 600, there's only two people who have spear and sheep and sword.
Yeah, just him and Jonathan.
Everybody else has farm implements.
Right. Well, you can do a lot of damage with a sickle if you know how to wield it. I mean, you know, I think it's maybe a little bit of both, that, you know, he trusts in God to deliver him to victory, but also there's a foolhardiness to this. And, you know, his numbers have been reduced significantly by the fear of his countrymen. And, you know, but you got to make a stand. You got to do something, and so I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, Saul's not a uniformly bad person, so in a way, it's kind of impressive that you're willing to go up against a force that radically outnumbers you. But there is kind of a foolhardiness to it as well, especially when you're basically unarmed. You know, you're asking people to do the impossible. But the impossible is possible with God. So I think it's probably a little bit of both and. Yeah.
he was lucky the Hebrews jumped in.
That was helpful, yeah.
That was real helpful.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to rely on side switchers, but sure he was glad to have them. And, you know, as things, you know, got better and better, the folks climbed out of their bolt holes and decided they would help out too. So we went from 600 to 10,000 very quickly. And, you know.
I think about the Philistines, they were watching Jonathan and his armored carrier crawling hands and knees up the hill to him and just standing waiting until he's all covered his breath and standing upright and ready. You know, it didn't happen as they came up, quite honestly.
Well, you know, they must have been snorting with laughter, and you know, I imagine that they were kind of the cat getting ready to play with the mice. I mean, this was a ridiculous situation, and you know, and when you consider the sort of numbers that are mentioned in the first half of chapter 13, I mean, we don't know how many people were in this stronghold. But they come up and they sort of go all ninja warrior and they manage to kill 20 people. I mean, which is impressive, but I mean, it's a very small percentage of your overall force. And this isn't a movie either. And so, the fact that they panicked, I mean, maybe they saw that, you know, these guys were, you know, really, laying down the law, and they realized, we've dealt with these Israelites before. Only God can empower somebody to accomplish something like this. Obviously, their God is present. We're frightened of him, and they panic. You know.
Do you think in chapter verse 15, the ground shook? Do you think God made an earthquake?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that this was a definitive sign of God's presence. Although I suppose it could be interpreted as the ground shaking because you have an enormous number of people who are running around like chickens with their heads cut off,
right.
You know, not really sure what to do, scared out of their skulls. So, yeah.
This says that when the ground shook, for other instances of divine intervention in nature to bring deliverance to Israel.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there are lots of sort of supernatural occurrences that indicated God's presence and intervention, and you know, my interpretation is that this earthquake was, you know, sent by God, because immediately afterwards it says, and it became a very great panic. So they were scared to death beforehand, and then it got worse after the earthquake. So I think it was more than just sort of the trembling of the ground that you would find with a large number of people running around. I think that this was a bona fide tectonic event. So.
Question the intelligence of people that their enemy is going to sharpen their tools of war, you know. I would not even think of that, to go to those guys and say, would you sharpen this for me?
Yeah, I mean, I found that curious as well. I mean, but they're not asking them to sharpen their spears or their swords. The Philistines aren't going to do that. And apparently they don't even have them to start with to get sharpened. They're asking them to sharpen their farm implements, which is peculiar. Because, you know, that means that you're facilitating, you know, the feeding of your enemy by helping them harvest their food more easily. But they were charging them for it. And, you know, you talk about abject humiliation, you know. You know, just to get your sickle sharpened so you can bring in the wheat, you have to go to your enemy and say, you sharpen this for me? Yes.
What's happening right now with the Palestinians on the West Bank, having to, the only place they can find work or money to feed their families, is to go across outside the wall and into Jerusalem to work in the desert, and essentially their enemy's territory.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing.
It just keeps repeating and repeating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that when we had the reading about all the territories around Saul's kingdom, we were enemies, you know, and I thought, mm-hmm. that comes out of the Middle East today.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it always has been and ever shall be a heavily contested piece of territory. I've mentioned it before, but it bears repeating. It's the only place in the planet where you have the juncture of three continents. And for the most part, it's fertile ground. You have good ports on the Mediterranean. So between the trade routes, the fertility of the soil, bearing some very valuable commodities, olives, figs, citrus fruit, along with the staples. And then you have the sea access, as well as land routes into Egypt, to the east, as far as you want to go, and then up into Europe. I can't think of another geographical place like it in terms of being a central nexus for so much.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all mentioned because obviously the Edomites are from Abraham's firstborn out of Anna.
Yeah.
Here they're distant cousins, maybe way distant, but they are related through blood, way back.
Well, and sometimes you fight the most with the ones that you're closest to. Yeah.
Canaan, Moab. Moses asked permission to cross the Moab territory, and the king of Moab denied it, which is why they had to go so far around that area to get into the Holy Land. Moab is where Petra is right now.
Hmm. The Moabites and the Ammonites are Lot's children. By his daughters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So there's another family mess.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
Moses and the king of Moab. Does Jonathan ever make it up with his father? I mean, he's pretty done. Jonathan McCall would be in trouble for the country.
Yeah. His father's going to kill him.
Yeah.
I'm thinking the relationship might be going downhill.
I would say that there was never a firm reconciliation. I'll just put it like that. The story of Saul goes on for a while, and I'll be honest, I've not read that far ahead. But if you look at the first verse of chapter 18. When David had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then John made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. As a result, Saul sent him over the army, blah, blah, blah. So definitely there's a transference of primary allegiance from Jonathan, from Saul to David as far as Jonathan's concerned. And, of course, since David succeeds Saul, I think, yes, that you could argue that this is... relationship that ultimately was unreconciled. I mean, I don't want to give you too many spoilers. I want you to come back. But not next week. Remember, we're off next week. But the week after, first Wednesday of January, we'll be back on.
I have a question.
Urim and Thummim, or whatever those.
Urim and Thummim.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And they were like dice, right?
We think they were stones.
Stones that you would throw?
No. Well, the mechanism is not made clear anywhere in the Old Testament in terms of, you know, did you stick them in a bag and pull one out? Or, you know, did you toss them up into the air? And yeah, and we're just not given a lot of information apart from the fact that they were highly regarded, apparently sacred. You know, they were identified in Exodus as, you know, important parts of the priestly vestments. And, you know, if you needed a yes-no answer from God, this is by and large what you used, were these two stones.
So when it says, cast the lot between me and my son Jonathan,
mm-hmm.
that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the Urim and the Thummim.
And we think of the word cast, we think of, you know, throwing.
Yeah. And if I recall correctly, Urim means cursed and Thummim means blessed. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
Hence the phrase rolling the dice.
Oh, yeah, I mean, many of the games we play today have very ancient origins, and among them dice in one form or another, or casting stones or whatever, have a long history. But what are games for us today in ancient times often were, you know, sources of divination that were taken with the utmost seriousness. In fact, you know, you may recall in one of the crucifixion narratives, the soldiers crucifying Jesus, he has a very fine linen tunic, Jesus does, woven. It's in one piece. It's valuable. In fact, for most people, clothing was the most valuable possession that they owned. And instead of dividing it among themselves, they decide they're going to play dice for it. And in a way, you know, this is something soldiers did. They gambled. They played dice, however they did it. And but because of the use of dice, essentially, or stones, to divine God's will, at the foot of the cross, they're essentially playing a game that is sacrilegious, in order to determine which one of them gets to keep the tunic. So yeah, very, very old practice. Yeah. We've got about 10 minutes, and I'm more than welcome to continue the conversation, but we were promised a party, as I recall. So week after next, in the new year, we're going to do 16, and we're going to do some of 17, but I haven't decided how much yet. So just go ahead and read through the end of 17. Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah, I just got too eager there. So we'll do 15 and 16 next week. 15 and 16, week after next. Is there any coffee left? Obviously, I'm losing it here.
You think it's time to quit?